RN Miami Herald News, I'm Kelly Mitchell. Paul, back to y'all. Now that rhymed.
And good afternoon. It's Topical Current, 6 minutes after one on this Tuesday afternoon. I'm Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper on vacation. What was the relationship between religion and power in the ancient world? And how did that relationship play into the adoption of a tiny Jewish cult led by Jesus to become the official religion of the Roman Empire? With thousands of gods competing with one another, why did Christianity grow so quickly to become the predominant world religion? Today, we visit with radio and television producer and author Selina O'Grady. She explores these questions and many more in her book, And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. Selina O'Grady joins us from the studios of the BBC in London. Welcome and thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Bonnie.
Hi. I found it interesting. Why did you change the subtitle of your book from Kings, Cults, and Conquests at the Time of Jesus to A History of the World at the Time of Jesus?
I suppose because in a way it's a more encompassing title, that I am trying not just to look at kings and cults, but really to concentrate on this extraordinary phenomenon of a small little cult. At the time of Jesus' death, it probably numbered about 100 followers, and how that became the largest world religion that we have today. There are so many reasons, and I found that so fascinating. Although I embed it in a story of how religion and politics, in a sense, need each other, and why religion is so essential, I think, to every society that there has ever been and will ever be.
So do they still need each other today the way they did in the ancient world?
I would say absolutely. And we can see that not just in, I think there was a time in the 60s when certainly in Europe people thought religion is dying. I think no one would say that now. When we see, for instance, the Iranian Revolution, the growth of fundamentalism in Islam, and to some extent within America. I think to some extent what we will forever need is the sense of what gives us meaning and purpose in life. And religion does that better than anything else, I think.
But in the United States, it was determined that there would be this separation between church and state, no?
Absolutely. And to some extent, I think actually that's what Christianity does, that prior to Christianity, in a sense, religion and politics, religion and the world are completely unified. So in the Roman Empire, for instance, the Roman Emperor himself is considered to be related to the gods, to Mars and Venus. He actually becomes divine himself. He is both head of Roman religion and head of state. And the senators, for instance, the sort of the elite politicians, are both priests and politicians, because in a sense the welfare of the state is considered the business of religion stroke politics. I mean, there isn't really a distinction between them. It's Christianity that in a sense makes a sort of internal separate spiritual world as against the external political world. And that's why in a sense Jesus can say, render unto Caesar, and make that distinction.
Well, let's look at the end of the first century BC. When you say the ancient world was first experiencing the traumatic and disruptive effects of globalization, what changes were occurring and how did they impact the formation and development of the different religions?
Well, that's sort of strangely and paradoxically, it's the onset of peace that actually is so disruptive. Augustus, in a sense, heralds in a centuries of peace. There's been about probably 500 years of sort of war in Rome and civil war. He ushers in a period of comparative peace. And of course, peace brings prosperity, and with that, trade. And trade, of course, is wonderful in terms of increasing prosperity of a society, but it's also extraordinarily disruptive. I call it the first phase of globalization, that period at the beginning of the first century AD. And the reason, in a sense, it's so disruptive is the cities it creates, that you get these vast cities springing up, to which thousands of people are flocking and crowding in and squatting in it every day. And they're from all parts of the Roman Empire, from Spain to Syria. So you get Egyptians and rather unattractive Britons and Gauls, and you get people from every race and who inevitably are going to clash with each other, but who also have actually been torn away from their roots, their traditions, their customs, their family, their tribe. And so they are very frightening, alienating, violent places. And it's that, in a sense, that makes religion that much more important, and that makes religion, in a sense, have to respond to these new needs that are being thrown up.
Well, what was the landscape at that time regarding gods and paganism? What did it look like?
I think it was a completely fabulous but puzzling mix, that where you could, you brought your god with you. Some gods you couldn't bring. They were just sort of attached to their local glade or spring. But the ones that you could bring, you did. And so you get a huge sort of churning mishmash of all these different gods from all these different parts of the empire. So you get Syrian goddesses, Egyptian goddesses, Roman gods, Greek gods, etc. And they're all mishing together. Some of them are actually, to some extent, coalesce. So you get gods that become bigger. And so you get someone, a goddess like Atargatis, for instance, the Syrian goddess, who becomes the goddess of love, of peace, of war, of fertility, of virginity. She becomes a huge and astonishing sort of contradiction of characteristics and virtues. And the reason, in a sense, that the pagan gods can do this is because pagan religion has, in a sense, no beliefs at all. It has rituals, so you'd all come together for a meal. And, for instance, if you go to a banquet of Atargatis, you're told not to have sex with a woman or a dog beforehand, not to be sick in the temple when you have your ritual meal, and not to do any graffiti on the walls of the temple. But it's really, it's a question of these rituals, these communal meals, rather than of a god saying, you must do this and this and this. That's really only comes later with the development of certain pagan religions, such as the cult of Isis, which I think is a fascinating one as being sort of on the cusp between the pagan beliefless religion and the Jewish Christian belief, a religion sort of soaked in belief.
Now, and we'll talk more about that. Speaking of Augustus, now, you say he was trying to manufacture the cult of the divine emperor in Rome, but didn't his uncle have a little bit of failure trying to do the same thing? What did he do differently?
Well, yeah, he had a major problem, which was he was assassinated by his senators. And the reason that he was, this is Julius Caesar, the reason that he was is that he tried to overtly declare himself as dictator, as sole ruler of the empire. Now, his nephew Augustus was in effect in exactly the same position, i.e. he had defeated Mark Antony and he was the sole ruler, but he was sensible and politically astute enough never to declare himself as that. So there was always this huge farce in Rome that he was re-voted annually or however every other year to the position of temporary sole leader, but on the whole he would rule with his senators. So he had three superb spin doctors with him who did manufacture a cult of the divine Augustus, but very sensibly avoided ever making him divine in Rome itself. So he was considered to be divine in the eastern and western parts of the empire, but within Rome and Italy he was never allowed to be declared a god, and no temple to him as a god was ever allowed to be built. So it was a very clever manipulation, but yes, he absolutely needed God behind him, as would have Julius Caesar, but he was not such a good and careful politician, nor did he have such good advisors as Augustus had.
Interesting. So how did the Roman Empire, as it conquered these new lands, instill their gods onto the people who had their own gods, and how did those who were conquered react?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I think that, as I said before, that the fact that pagans don't really have beliefs attached to their gods, mm-hmm. made it much easier for Rome to come in and, in a sense, to colonise those gods, to actually incorporate them as part of their pantheon of gods. So you get the Syrian goddess Atacartes, for instance, is also equated to Hera. So that statues to her are considered to be both Hera and Atacartes. And in a sense, this is a great way of colonising your conquered people, because they've kept their gods, but they've been Romanised at the same time. And for so many people in these conquered areas, it was, in fact, there were a huge amount of advantages in becoming Romanised. You admittedly, you had to pay taxes, but Rome did bring with it peace and prosperity and, to a large extent, law and order. So it was really quite worth your while to accept this idea of the colonisation of your gods. Some of them, of course, were actually powerful enough, in a sense, to resist that. And Isis, I would say, who was one of the most popular goddesses of the time, gods of the time, she did resist that Romanization. In fact, on the contrary, Rome, in a sense, adopted her. Certainly the emperors after Augustus did.
And still Christianity became the religion of the Roman Empire.
Yes. And it is. So, for instance, had I been around at the time, I would have definitely thought Isis was going to be the most popular religion of all time. It had the great advantage of being brought by merchants, by soldiers, by slaves to all parts of the empire. And two, it had a lot of what Christianity would in fact do far better. But it was beginning to become a religion to the extent that that Isis was beginning to be a personal god, that her devotees would pray to her and would expect her to listen to them because she loved them to some extent. She also was beginning to promise some kind of afterlife. It's not quite clear exactly whether this was just a prolongation of life on Earth or whether it was actually somewhere else. And on top of that, she was demanding some kind of moral behaviour from her followers. It's not quite clear what, unfortunately, now. We just don't have enough information about her. But she was clearly expecting some sort of ascetic behaviour from her followers, because sort of Roman satirists at the time mock the Isis devotees for being ascetics, for jumping into the river Tiber when it was icy cold and sort of crawling along on their knees, etc. So she is beginning to become what we recognise in Christianity as a true religion. But Christianity ended up by doing this so much better than Isis ever managed.
Well, we'll pick that up after we take a short break. We're speaking with Selina O'Grady, a television radio producer, editor, and author, and her latest book is And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. We'll take that break and come back and take your calls and your emails. Stay with us.
You can join Carmen Rodriguez and the Little White House Band on the north lawn of the Truman Little White House in Key West for a dance and musical celebration of Harry S. Truman's 130th birthday, May 7th at 8 p.m. The night will be filled with music, dancing, merriment, appetizers, and libations. Complimentary cake and champagne will be served to finish off this evening under the stars. Reservations at 305-295-7676 or keystix.com. Brought to you by the Monroe County Tourist Development Council.
Michelle Martin is coming to Miami. MCCJ presents Breakfast with Emmy Award-winning NPR journalist Michelle Martin, host of Tell Me More, Thursday, May 8th at Jungle Island, 8 to 10 a.m. You can reserve your seat for Breakfast with Michelle Martin at miamiccj.org or 305-755-6096. That's miamiccj.org or 305-755-6096. Hollywood Animal Hospital is offering free eye exams to service animals during the month of May. Owners and handlers can register from April 1st to the 30th. More information about this and their special May 4th event can be found on their website, hollywoodanimal.com. From the WLRN Community Bulletin Board.
You can get the news from the BBC World Service live overnight every night on WLRN Extra HD. Now with more power and better coverage in South Florida. Listen on your HD radio at 91.3-2 or live online at WLRN.org.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with Selina O'Grady. She's the author of And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. Questions, comments, your views, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Selina, you argue that Judaism doesn't work for people in an empire turning to Judaism, yet the Jews of the diaspora had flourishing communities within, let's say, the Roman Empire. So could you explain that for us?
Yeah. So at this time, there was probably about, I'd say about 5 to 6 million Jews in the Roman Empire. They make up about 5 to 10% of the population of the empire. Their religion is an extraordinarily successful one for a people that don't have a homeland. So what they have is a uniquely at the time, they have one sole God, and the pagans thought this was sort of a laughable, extraordinary idea. But what this God says to the Jews is, I will look after you and eventually take you back to your homeland if you follow my laws. And those laws extend over the whole of life, not just religion, but how you conduct your trade, how you have sex, how you farm, how you eat, etc. And this is an extraordinarily successful religion for keeping a people that don't have a land together. It's disadvantage if you're living in an empire with a whole lot of other people and with an emperor who has a different religion from yours, is that it makes you so distinctive, and it constantly makes you think, do you obey the emperor at this point or do you obey your God? Because occasionally, or quite often, those two authorities will clash. So it becomes very difficult for the Jews. It's wonderful in the sense that they are such a powerful, separate group that they can extract privileges from the emperor, and indeed they do, and that makes them extraordinarily unpopular and makes them subject perhaps more than any other group to violence and hatred.
What kind of privileges are you speaking of?
Well, perhaps the most crucial one of all is that you can pay taxes as a Jew to maintain your temple and maintain the sacrifices of your temple in Jerusalem. Now, that's an extraordinarily valuable privilege. It's one that the Romans would not really give to anyone else. Plus, Augustus had this wonderful ruse, as sort of negotiated clearly with the Jews, which is that everyone else had to sacrifice to the divine emperor. The Jews could sacrifice to the health of the emperor. They didn't have to say that the emperor was divine. So that there were these kind of privileges. Plus, uniquely, it was virtually a sort of a city within a city. They had their own, as it were, city council, which decided a lot of their own rules. So this made them unique. It made them hated. And the first pogrom, the first ghetto erected for the Jews, was in fact in about 30 BC in Alexandria, where the Greeks absolutely loathed the Jews. So it's an extraordinarily difficult religion for an emperor, because, as I say, the religious laws will often be at odds with the Roman laws.
I was just going to ask, why did they grant them those privileges?
I think because they were such a powerful group, and they often found that actually the Jews needed the support of the Romans. So, for instance, in about the 60s BC, the Jews came out in favour of Pompey in the civil wars. Pompey then granted them certain privileges. And so it was a history, in a sense, of a powerful group giving its support to a particular ruler, say, who would then grant them privileges in return.
So it was one hand washing the other.
Yes, that's right. And also, to some extent, they were powerful enough that they could really make trouble, I would think, if they hadn't got some privileges.
Make trouble, meaning?
Well, you don't want, as an emperor, you don't want too disruptive a group of people. And if the Jews, given their quite significant presence in each of these major cities, you really do want them on your side.
So how did Herod the Great resolve this problem he had between those religious Jews and those who lived under the Roman rule?
Well, unfortunately for him, he utterly failed. He thought he could be both a sort of a good Roman king and a good Jew. It was actually impossible, made increasingly impossible by the Pharisees, who were a sort of new group within Judaism, which is trying to popularize it. It's trying to wrest it away from the hands of the Jewish political and religious aristocrats, the Sadducees. In popularizing it, it increasingly radicalizes many of the Jews in Judea who find it, who, thanks to the Pharisees in a sense, find it increasingly impossible to obey Rome. So you get, during the time of Herod the Great, an extraordinary revolt led by the Pharisees. It's a student revolt, and they go into the temple, they climb these 60-foot high gates and smash, or at least topple, bring down, haul down this huge statue which Herod had erected in the temple and smash it to pieces. And this is a deliberate act of protest against Herod for being so blasphemous as to erect a statue of something that represents real life, in a sense, in the temple. So Herod is quite often, from then on, faced with rebellions, protests, which he puts down savagely, and where the Jews are quite are sort of prepared to die heroically for the sake of their God. And when poor Herod dies, he dies of bowel cancer, and he's, you know, stinking breath, he's rotting, he's lying in his palace bemoaning the death of his favourite wife, who he himself had murdered. He knows that he's failed so badly that he in fact orders the one member of every important family in Judea to be murdered on his death, so that there would be official mourning even if it wasn't for him. In fact, thank God, that was countermanded by his successors. But he knew he was unpopular. He knew he'd lost his the goodwill of virtually everyone in the kingdom.
Let's take a call, because Bob's been waiting in Miami for quite a while. Hi, Bob. Welcome to Topical Currents.
Hi, thank you. Very interesting topic. I just wanted to make, I guess, what would be a side note to the conversation, that there were no monotheistic religions early on. Even the Jewish religion was pantheistic, and Yahweh, who became the primary God, was just one of a collection of gods. And he came to strength in much the way that the caller described that other gods came to strength, by consolidation. I think the Hebrews were conquered, either the Babylonians or the Assyrians, and the reason was attributed to the displeasure, I think, of Yahweh for the way that the Hebrews were conducting. And so it was kind of an opportunistic move by his particular priests to bring him into power. So the Jewish religion, which started out as pantheistic, grew into a monotheistic religion the same way that the caller is describing the rise of Christianity.
That's absolutely right, that the Judaism precisely did start as, or at least Yahweh began, in a sense, as one of several gods, and then gradually coalesced. And as I, in a sense, say in my book, there's no inevitable path from many gods to one single god, nor is there necessarily a path from the one single god to the moral god and to the moral loving god. And those are all paths that that Judaism and Christianity took, but which a lot, clearly, of those other religions failed to do. So Zoroastrianism, for instance, which is one of the religions I look at in connection with the Persian Empire, the Parthian Empire as it was then, is a religion that is almost getting to that stage of a monotheistic god. It has a supreme god, but not a single god. And this god is not a Ahura Mazda is not a jealous god in the sense that Yahweh is. He doesn't demand soul devotion from his followers. They are allowed to worship other gods, but it's certainly going along that route of the monotheistic god.
Is okay, Bob?
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. What about ISIS? Did they require only that she only be worshipped? Did that require?
No. No. You see, she didn't. A lot of followers would perhaps have worshipped her more than any other god, but there was nothing to stop them from worshipping other gods as well. And most sensible pagans would have thought that was the only thing to do, that you've got to hedge your bets. That one god will be better at giving you fertility, another god will be better at giving you a good harvest. And although Isis was becoming a supreme god, you might as well, there was absolutely no reason, no penalty involved in hedging your bets and going for some other, and bribing other gods as well with your sacrifices, which is sort of what pagan religion was. It was a bribe. And there's a wonderful Latin expression, which is do et des, I give so that you may give. And that's in a sense what these early pagan religions were.
Our number, 1-800-743-9576, to speak to Selena O'Grady, television, radio producer, editor, and author of And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. We are going to take another short break, and we'll be back with more of your calls.
A colorectal screening, it could save your life. That's because while colon cancer is the nation's second leading cause of cancer death, it's also one of the most treatable forms of the disease, if caught early. So starting at age 50, you may want to get screened. It could save your life. You could learn more at browardhealth.org/screening or by calling 954-759-7400. Broward Health, powerful medicine.
Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Wednesday's Topical Currents and a discussion with Columbia University neuroscientist and substance abuse research professor, Dr. Carl Hart. He's written High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery That Challenges Everything You Know About Drugs and Society. His insights come firsthand. He grew up in Miami's Carroll City area and overcame long odds to reach the Ivy League. Don't miss it. Topical Currents, Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
We're funded by listeners like you and by Disability Rights Florida, providing protection and advocacy services to people with disabilities statewide for 35 years. Disability Rights Florida, on the web at disabilityrightsflorida.org.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you and Selena O'Grady, whose latest book is And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. To join in the conversation, ask a question or a comment, the number 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576 or email radio at WLRN.org. Selena, in one of the chapters of your book, it opens with a description of a holy man wandering through Galilee, preaching, healing the sick, performing miracles, and then we discover it wasn't Jesus at all. So how common was it to have messiahs at that time?
Well, it was surprisingly common. There were a lot of holy men who were considered to have performed miracles, who had their band of ascetic followers who would wander around preaching. Janina Bendoza, the Messiah that I mention, was probably the most famous, was more famous than Jesus, I'd say, at that time. Anyone who's seen Monty Python's Life of Brian, it's a comedy about that period, but it gets it right in terms of the amount of messiahs that there were. And there's one wonderful historian of this time who says that messiahs were springing up like sort of mushrooms in damp soil, and that's very much how it seems. But even emperors, for instance, were said to have performed miracles. Tacitus is a great sober Roman historian of that time, and he quite, with no surprise in his tone, says that Thespesian, you know, healed a blind man, healed another girl from her sickness. So in a sense, it wasn't that the miracle was not such a surprising thing. The exorcism of demons was not so surprising because no one divided off the body from the spirit. And so why not explain illness by devils as much as by what they didn't understand at the time of, you know, blood, or they had some strange ideas of what physically was going on, but there was no real distinction between those physical sort of maladjustments and the devilish maladjustments.
Let's talk to Andy in Fort Lauderdale, who wants to talk to you about how Jesus became God. Hi, Andy.
Uh-huh. Right.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you, Ms. O'Grady. I just finished Bart Ehrman's book, How Jesus Became God, and he makes the case that the Christian understanding of the divinity of Jesus evolved over hundreds of years. And I'd like to hear you comment on that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thank you, Andy.
So I would say that, in a sense, actually, it's earlier than that. It's really John, the Gospel of John, which is in the 2nd century AD, that starts the whole idea of Jesus being divine. Paul, for instance, who's writing earlier than John, is unclear about his divinity. He never comes down really on one side or the other. But John, I think, is very clear that Christ is divine. And it's from then on that you get the disagreements about how the Trinity works, what it actually means to be the Son of God. But I think, but certainly the connection of Jesus with divinity is quite clear by the time of John. I hope that answers your question.
I hope so, because he did go off the line. How did the Romans view Jesus and these other messiahs?
That becomes an increasing problem. In a sense, thanks to the Pharisees during the first century BC, the whole idea of the Messiah becomes increasingly politicized. It begins within Judaism as simply meaning the anointed king. But it slowly becomes... not just Messiah becomes not just the anointed king, but the king who will, with God, bring the Jews back to their homeland to rule over a sort of heaven on earth. And that, by the time of Jesus, means getting rid of the Romans. So it becomes highly politicized and highly seditious. And that is why Jesus becomes not just the subject of a Jewish court and Jewish law for being blasphemous, but becomes the subject of Roman law, because the claims that he is a Messiah mean that he is potentially extraordinarily seditious and dangerous. So it's a highly politicized term by the time of Jesus. But Paul, who we haven't really talked about, but should, because he's so crucial to this whole story of Christianity, it's Paul that actually depoliticizes the whole notion of the Messiah
I'm sorry.
No, carry on.
No, I was going to say, let's talk about Paul now. Because you say he's the greatest marketer any religion ever had. So tell us about Paul.
Well, I think, and I'm not alone in saying this, that he is the creator of Christianity, that without him, that small cult of Jesus might well have stayed a small cult, despite the beauty of Jesus's message. You need a brilliant theologian, a brilliant missionary, a brilliant organizer, all of which Paul was. He was bad-tempered, bandy-legged, self-righteous, but he was brilliant. And he universalized Judaism, and that's what it had to do in order to become a world religion, that is, have a huge number of followers. So what he did was he took the tenets of Judaism, some of them, the most crucially, love your neighbor and love your God. But he said, to be part of this religion of Jesus, you don't need to be a Jew, you don't need to be circumcised, you don't need to follow the law, all you need is faith. And his aim was to say there will neither be, under thanks to Jesus, there will be neither Greek nor Jew, neither man nor woman, neither slave nor free. So everyone has a role in this religion, is uniquely loved by God, and that is in a sense all that is needed. You need to love God, and God will automatically therefore love you. So he opens it up in this way, and he provides for these new rootless people in the city who are desperate for sort of meaning and community. He provides them with the best new community you could have, in a sense, which is, it's based on the family. He addresses everyone in his missionary work as brother and sister in Christ. He sends them kisses. The whole structure of the church is based on the home, on the house church. And it's from there that Christianity, like a wonderful virus, spreads. But over it all, Paul keeps his loose command. So he's constantly writing letters to everyone, telling them off, getting furious, exciting them, sending his love.
Writing letters to whom?
to his new convert. So he travels round Turkey and the Near East. But I should say that this is much against the wishes of most of the apostles. All the rest of the apostles have met, have talked with, have sat with Jesus. Paul alone hasn't. He's a latecomer. But he's saying Jesus's message is not just for the Jews. Jesus himself has said, my message is only for the Jews. He specifically says that. And that is what his brother James, who's now sort of the leader of this little cult, thinks it should be. That's what the other apostles think. Paul says, no, you're all wrong. Actually, Jesus's message was for everyone, and I'm going out to missionarise on that. And there is a sort of split between the conservative apostles and Paul the radical. And we always like to think of Paul now as a sort of extreme conservative who's sort of very anti-women. Actually, at the time, he was a great radical and sort of gave women a place in a religion which they had in no other religion at the time.
Well, but ISIS had a place.
Aha, yes, she did. She certainly had her priestesses, but none of them had the power that women in the early church had, i.e. The women in the early church were often the sort of the founders of the house church in their area. They were the leaders of the Christians in their area. Like Lydia, for instance, she was a Greek woman. She was the first European convert. She had her own purple dye business. She started the first church in Philippi, in this trading port city. And Paul relied on a lot of these women. He even had one that, you know, he sent out as an apostle. He called her his apostle, and relied on her to go out and do her missionary work. We never hear of her anymore, but he certainly called her an apostle and relied on her as he did on many women.
Well, when did the women lose their power in the church?
That's a good question. I think it starts when the church becomes more of a sort of hierarchical organisation, when the church leaves the house church and goes into sort of organised buildings, when you start getting a hierarchy of bishops and priests. And these, unfortunately for women, were all taken over by men. And it's at that point when the doctrine, when what is considered to be the writings of the accepted writings of the church start being decided on. So out go, there was a Gospel of Mary, there was the Acts of Paul and Thecla. These sorts of writings just disappear from the canon. And I think it's because male authority and organisational authority takes over.
Let's talk to Andy in Miami, who's been waiting quite a while. And, of course, you do go into other major religions in your book. He wants to ask about that. Yes. Andy, welcome to Topical Currents.
Oh, thank you. Yes, hi. I'm listening, and I almost want to change my question, but I'll still go ahead and ask it. At the time of Christ, where was the what was the influence of Hinduism, you know, with regards to that you know, to people at that time? I mean, there's a lot of older religions that were, you know, there was about, and I'm just curious as to what, you know, what role did that play? Was that was a pagan religion at the time, or what enlightenment can you
That's a very interesting question. Absolutely right. Hinduism had been going for centuries. The interesting thing for me about Hinduism at that time is that Buddhism is slowly evolving in reaction to Hinduism, and Hinduism responds by developing itself. So Buddhism starts developing a more populist form by creating, in a sense, personalised, by making Buddha a personalised god, by having saints that you can pray to. Hinduism responds by creating its own personal god. So it begins by just having Brahman, who is this sort of absolute with no character, with no personality, with no personal characteristics. It's simply the absolute. But in response, probably, to this new sort of popular form of Buddhism, it develops its own personal gods. So it develops this idea of Krishna, who's the human embodiment of the god Shiva, Who is the loving God, and you as a Hindu follower pray to Krishna, and your devotion in a sense ensures your salvation. So Hinduism is evolving, and it is a crucial, I mean it's most definitely a religion rather than I wouldn't call it pagan. I mean it's a religion to the extent that it has very beliefs about how you should live your life and what is good and what is bad. And it's certainly integral to a political state. The chief minister of a Hindu state would have to be a Brahmin, for instance. There's a wonderful one of my favourite characters, in a sense, in my book, is this 4th century Brahmin advisor to the first emperor of India. And he suggests to the emperor all sorts of tricks to play on his people, to convince his people that he is a god and or that he's sort of divinely associated with gods. But Hinduism is absolutely embedded in the state at the time, although it sometimes fluctuates with Buddhism as the religion of the state. I hope that slightly answered your question.
Yes. I was trying to get to the Why would people switch religion is where I was trying to get to.
I see.
You know what?
Right.
But I understand about Buddhism definitely. And I was trying to think, like, in today's world, if someone were to, create a god or come up with an idea of a god, what would it be like? I mean, like, our values of goodness and what's right and wrong and all that is still basically the same. What kind of god would someone?
Yes, I think that's a great question. And I would say that the sort of the nearest we have to a new religion, perhaps, is Gaia and the whole sort of care for the planet. That's the closest we've got to a new religion, because it is concentrating on how we should live our life, what the purpose of our life is. We are making something sacred, which is the life of our whole planet.
Nature.
Yes, so I think that's the closest we've got to a religion. But of course, to some extent, new sects are springing up all the time. It's just that most of them aren't that good and are led by corrupt people who want to make money and have sex rather than actually help people.
Okay, thank you, Andy, for calling.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, we're speaking with Selena O'Grady. She's the author of And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. Need to take one more short break. We'll come back with more calls and your email. Stay with us.
Florida National University's Summer Term A starts on May 5th. Their Master of Health Services Administration program is designed to provide high-quality professional education in order to assist executives and prepare the new generation of healthcare professionals to be part of leading positions in the administration, management, and planning of the healthcare industry. Florida National University's classes are available online or on campus. Details at 305-821-3333 or fnu.edu.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, new music from the old 97s.
This is the ballad of drinking rye whiskey and sleeping till 2 on a warm afternoon.
The New Yorker calls the new CD most messed up, blistered, blasted, and brilliant. Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, up next, 2 o'clock here on 91.3 WLRN.
Welcome back to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Bonnie Berman with you and Selena O'Grady, the author of And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. And we will have links to the book on our website, WLRN.org, and on the Facebook page. And also, I see your website, Selena, is SelenaO'Grady.com.
That's right.
No apostrophe.
No apostrophe, absolutely.
Okay, we have an emailer. Steve would like you to expand on how Christianity was responsible for separation of church and state, that your response that Jesus said, give unto God and unto Caesar, is not sufficient in view of today's right-wing Christianity in the U.S.
I don't quite understand the last bit, that my response is not sufficient. Well, I'm not quite sure.
I guess when I asked you, we were talking, I guess you said something about how Christianity actually
separates.
Separates, yes, and that's what he's asking. And he's saying he's looking for what's happening in the United States today with some proponents of the right wing calling for a Christian state.
Right. So in terms of that creation of the distinction, I think it's that what Christianity does is to make this internal realm, that what is important now in terms of your religion is your personal relationship to God. It has nothing in a way that before religion was a public event, it was a ritual. Now it's a question of a personal relationship, of a feeling of love, of a reciprocal relationship of love. So it becomes a personal, individual relationship with your God in a way that it never was before. And that's why religious and the state get separated off, because the state now is in a different realm. It has nothing. You as an individual aren't involved in a personal relationship with the state. The state is simply supervising your taxes, etc. God is, but your relationship with God is now a supremely personal one, and it's that which creates the that separation. As for America today, it seems to me that America begins its life as deliberately separating church and state. Mm-hmm. It was a wonderful thing to do because it did extend religious freedom to people. I think it would be terribly sad to see the loss of that extension of religious freedom and religious liberty to people if you started saying this is a Christian state. And therefore, in a sense, by saying this is a Christian state, you privilege the Christian. And the whole idea of the separation of church and state was to say there is no privilege for a particular group of people. We are we accept people of all faiths and all religions.
We have an emailer. It says, I don't know if it's he or she is not religious, but how did Rome end up being the home for the Pope if, for what I understand, Romans dislike Christians and Jews? Well, no, they became Christian. And if Jews began with such similar belief system as Christians, what makes Jews different?
What makes Jews different is, I think, the Jewish law initially. It's that, as I say, Christians say we'll follow some of the most wonderful tenets of Judaism, plus the idea of a monotheistic God. But to be Christian, we don't have to follow these rules set out by the Jewish God. That's the crucial difference. On top of that, of course, they do have the son of a human made divine, and that for the Jews at the time of Jesus is an absolute blasphemy. The idea that human can become divine. For most of the eastern part of the Roman Empire, it's absolutely standard in a sense. Ever since Alexander the Great conquered the East in the 4th century BC, but for the Jews, that's an absolute blasphemy. Mm-hmm. Now, what was the other part of the question? Why the Pope in Rome?
Right.
Because, I mean, I think, Bonnie, exactly as you said, because Rome adopts Christianity.
Right.
The Roman emperor becomes a Christian. Constantine becomes, in the 4th century BC AD, the first Christian emperor. By the end of the 4th century AD, Christianity has become adopted as the religion of the Roman Empire, and the emperor at the time bans all pagan temples and all pagan gods. So that's why Rome is the seat of political and religious power.
So where once it was an elective religion, now it's become mandatory.
That's a good question. Absolutely. That's absolutely right. And of course, the beauty of that early Christianity was precisely that it was elective. Mary Beard, the great classical historian, calls the cult of Isis one of these sort of early elective religions, for the same reason that you choose to belong to Isis, you chose to be a Christian. You didn't choose to worship the divine Augustus. That was just part of being Roman.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller, Alicia in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Alicia. Good afternoon.
Hi. I'm loving this conversation, and I want to get your book, and I'm a Christian, and I heard you say that back during, I guess, I don't know if you said before or during Jesus' time, there are tons of messiahs around, or people who call themselves messiahs, and someone who was more popular than him. From your perspective, why do you think Jesus took hold and became the one that we still, you know today?
I would say, one, because of what he actually says, but I'm afraid to say, and perhaps you won't like this, but as importantly, he had Paul as a brilliant sort of promoter of this religion and creator of it. It also answered the needs of the ruler and the people better than anything else did. So from the ruler's point of view, what Christianity said, and this message in a way could not have been better for any ruler, it was saying, love your neighbour, i.e. in this disruptive empire with all these different people in it, love everyone in it. Then it said, obey authority, it is God-given. Paul specifically says that. And thirdly, it says, accept your humble state. Don't revolt. Don't be restive under your miserable lot, because you will get your rewards in heaven. But it is your duty, and it is a wonderful thing to be humble and to be poor. In fact, it's even better than being rich. So that couldn't have been better from the ruler's point of view. From the ruled point of view, I think, the message of love, of life everlasting, of the fact that you will get your rewards in heaven are wonderful messages. And I think that Paul's creation of the new family was wonderfully soothing and addressed many needs of the time. And a group we haven't mentioned at all are the merchants, who are sort of becoming a very strong group at this time, but who are universally despised by aristocrats from Rome to China. And Christianity, again, because it says everyone is equal and equally loved by God, finds a place in this new religion, which they don't find in any of the other religions.
Mm. Interesting. Well, thank you. Okay, interesting. Alicia, thanks so much for calling.
Thank you.
Thank you. We only have about a minute left, Selena, and we didn't get to the other empires that you say in one way or another established and strengthened a grip on the territory and peoples with a certain religion pairing. But I guess we'll just have to read the book to find that out.
And please do.
Yes, yes. Selena O'Grady is a television and radio producer, editor, and author. Her book is And Man Created God, A History of the World at the Time of Jesus. Her website is selenaogrady.com. We want to thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. It's our pleasure to have you with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. And we apologize to the emailers and callers that we didn't get on today. So sorry. Tomorrow's program's an encore presentation of a program with Dr. Carl Hart. He addresses the decades-long war on drugs and its futility, racist, and class prejudice in his book, High Price, A Neuroscientist's Journey of Self-Discovery, that challenges everything you know about drugs and society. Bonnie Berman, hoping your Tuesday is